Today's episode of the Mighty Parenting Podcast is brought to you by Acree, the on-demand virtual writing tutor for students. And Acree has a quick tip for parents today. After your student has done a little brainstorming, looked for inspiration, chosen that prompt, and they're getting ready to actually write their essay, they should outline their idea in the form of a thesis statement. They need to summarize their knowledge into a sentence or two to convey the answer to the prompt's objective. And if you'd like to get more information on getting help with your child's college essays or school essays, you can learn more and get a free trial at acree.com. E-C-R-E-E.com.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm your host, Sandy Fowler, and I want to thank you for supporting the podcast. Listening, rating, reviewing, subscribing, and sharing it all help us reach more parents. And also, connecting with us via email or on social media helps me create better shows for you when I know what you guys are looking for and what helps you and what you want more info on. All those things help me design shows that work for you. So thank you. Thank you for connecting with me. Thank you for supporting the show. Well, today's show, we are going to talk about connection. And this is a big concern for parents in this digital age. Things move fast and people don't seem to have time to talk, and we're distracted by our technology and our screens and all those things that we need to take care of. And when you take all of that and put together the speed at which people are going, which takes away their time, and that prevalence of devices and what they do to our time in our lives, it just seems that we've lost a lot of our connection time. I know our family has been impacted by this. I remember, oh my gosh, many, many, many years ago, my husband and I moved home from a 3-year stint in Germany. And this was during the days of you've got mail. So that's the time frame we're on, right? And we made a conscious effort at designing our life to honor some of the things we learned about living in Europe and some of the things we enjoyed about that connection and relaxation and recreation. And one aspect of that was TV. When we moved home, we chose to have just one TV in the house. And initially, we didn't even get cable for it. But once we found out that he couldn't get Red Wing games without cable, all bets were off. And that had to get hooked up. But when we lived in Germany, we had seen first happen what happened when we didn't have a television at all. And what happened was that we spent more quality time together, just the two of us, with friends, with coworkers, and we had two babies when we came home, and we wanted to maintain that quality of life. We wanted that for them. Well, we still only have one television and no cable, but my, oh my, oh my, how things have changed. Yeah, we only have one television, but with 4 cell phones, 3 tablets, 4 computers in the house, that actually makes it 12 TVs, even though there's only one that you would call a TV. And it makes a difference. Even right now, if we watch something on our actual television, that still invites communication and connection. People who are watching, we talk about it to agree what we want to watch. People make comments during the show. We often have to stop because people are making commentary, or we start a discussion on something, or afterwards we'll end up discussing what we saw. But I notice if someone just picks up a device, we're all sitting around the living room and someone wants to watch something on their own, they pick up a device, they're in the room with us, but they're not. Looking at that takes them out of the room into another world. And I see that all around me. It used to be that when you went to a doctor's office or you were waiting in line somewhere, you'd strike up a conversation with the strangers who are stuck in the same predicament with you. Not anymore. We all dive into another world. And good and bad all come with that. But one of the things that's happened is we've become disconnected. And I am very excited to be talking about this with today's guest. She's here to talk us about connection in the digital age. Her name is Ann Moss Rogers. She is a TEDx speaker and owner of the popular Emotionally Naked blog. She turned into an accidental leader as a suicide prevention advocate after her son Charles, who suffered from depression and addiction, died by suicide in June of 2015. Her memoir, Diary of a Broken Mind, was published this past October and includes her son's song lyrics. Ann Moss, welcome to Mighty Parenting.
Thank you so much for having me, Miss Sandy. I really appreciate it.
I know we're focusing on the connection piece and connecting in the digital age today. And I just wanted to take a minute before we start that and thank you for sharing so incredibly candidly about your family's life, your son Charles's struggles, and his dying by suicide. It's so important for parents to share all the lessons we learn from parenting. And you have done this so beautifully in your book and in your blog and now in all of your speaking. And I know it's, yes, I get that it's therapeutic for you too, but it's still, it's painful and it's difficult. And I appreciate that you're willing to open up and share all that with other parents and with the world. And we will, of course, have links to your book and your blog and your work in our show notes from today's show so that people can get even more than what we covered today. But I just wanted to take that moment and let you know that your efforts are very, very much appreciated.
Thank you for saying that, because it's a rejection business, right? I mean, anytime I go for a speaking engagement, there have been times I'm passed over because I had a son that killed himself, and that isn't considered success in a lot of arenas. And you know, I just appreciate how you put that. So thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. And you know, that again, before we get into the actual conversation, that's one of the things. There are two pieces to that. And I know we're not getting into a big discussion about this today, but one is the mental health piece. And there are so many things we could talk about in terms of that. But the bottom line is, we as a society, we as a medical community do not really have a great understanding of mental health and mental illness. So that's a huge challenge. And two, no matter what we're talking about, when it comes to parenting and kids, yes, as parents, we have a responsibility to parent well and do the best we can for our kids. And the flip side of that is that, and I know some people take this the wrong way, but we are not responsible for the way our kids turn out. And that's not me. I just said, yes, we have a responsibility to parent them well. That doesn't, you know, take us off the hook to say we don't need to parent well. But these are human beings who make their own decisions and make their own choices, who live with their own obstacles, who do the best they can do in their circumstances. But we are not responsible for everything that they do. And we have to, as parents, we have to live with the pain of that sometimes.
Yeah, we can't do it for them. And there are times we want to, but they have to learn their own lessons. They have to go through the whole learning cycle that we went through, you know, to get where we are now.
Exactly. Exactly. And you do that. You pull lessons from what has happened in your family's life. And you talked about Charles dealt with depression and addiction, but you said that, part of his struggle was impacted by the connection or lack of connection. So could you maybe share a little bit of that story with us so we can see what that means?
Sure. Well, Charles was all about connection. So I had two children, my son Richard is a film editor out in LA, and he was my oldest. And Charles was my more empathetic child. And right from the get-go, when he was a baby and a child, he needed more holding, more hugging, more lap time, more stories. He needed more of that connection than Richard ever did. Richard was far more independent. I mean, he needed some of that, but Charles needed a lot of it. So come the 1990s was when video games started to become big. And I remember Charles going and knocking on doors to get people to come outside and play. But instead, their screens were kind of seducing them, you know, to stay inside and skip that beautiful day. And I remember he would come back home looking dejected and sad. And he would say, "Nobody wants to come outside and play with me today." And Charles would orchestrate all kinds of games. I mean, and he would do all the work. I mean, he would get on the phone, and at that point it was a landline, and he would be calling people to play baseball, dodgeball, or a game he made up. And he always wanted people to come together. And he got into video games only when it was something that you could hear people, you know, but it still wasn't the same. He needed that face-to-face connection. And I saw that he struggled with that breakdown in community more than other kids seemed to be struggling with that piece of it.
I think that term, you said breakdown in community, and I think that is a great way of expressing what has happened in our culture. I see so many things on Facebook, and I talk to my friends, and we talk about how, yeah, when we were kids, we were outside and all we had to do was come home when the street lights came on. I know you said that in your book, and I laughed because that was our thing. And I always used to get mad at my dad going, "I don't know what time they come on. How am I supposed to plan?" And he's like, "Not my problem. Be home early. You don't have to walk in the door right before it turns on. You can come home earlier."
Right.
But it was this, we were out and I would come home at the end of the day and my mother had been out running errands and talking to people around town. So she knew everywhere I'd been all day, even though, you know, I covered probably 20 miles with, you know, when we were older, we were like, you know, 14 and we're out on our bikes and going different places with my friends. But there was that sense of community. There was that if you did something wrong, the neighbor was sitting out on the porch and you were going to get yelled at for what you did wrong. And there were block parties and friends gatherings and families gatherings. And when we got together, we went outside and we played baseball, the kids and the dads. And you know, for 4th of July, we were outside running around the block to see if we could make it around while our sparkler was lit. It was all of this stuff. None of what I said is hugely important, but that was all that face-to-face time that you mentioned in that community and that connection. And it's not just screens. People talk about screens, and we're going to talk about them today too, because that's a piece of it. But air conditioning is one of the things I've talked about.
Yeah.
Is, you know, no one wants to leave the nice air conditioned house. I go for a walk in the summer around here and I live in Michigan. And yes, it gets hot, but even when it's, you know, 72 degrees outside, we're the only house that has open windows. And so I think that our culture has just shifted and we don't have that connection. And I know, and you probably know even more than I do, but the studies that are coming out now and showing that loneliness feeling lonely is the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day, as far as the impact it has on your health.
Yeah, it's bad. I mean, think about this for a minute. So you've mentioned air conditioning, there's the size of our houses, there's the height of the fences we're putting around our homes. But think about how when the power is out, nobody loves it when the power is out. But that's when neighbors all go outside and they bring their chainsaws to help, you know, cut down trees if they can, or they talk more. This neighbor has a coffee pot that works. Can I bring you over a cup? You start to see that community when your power is out. And how can we you know, recreate that feeling on a more normal basis. So we're not going back to the time where we didn't have power. We're not going to go back to a time when there was no social media. How do we take today's community and start to integrate those connections in our current life? And that's really what we kind of have to look for. And we're human beings and we crave that connection. So we are going to figure this out. It's not like we need to do a 10-year study. It's something everybody wants. No one wants to be lonely and isolated, or most people don't. So as human beings, we will start to really gravitate towards those opportunities. And I think, you know, with kids sometimes integrating technology in a group exercise, whether it's, you know, just having an iPad that acts as a spinner for a game for a group of kids. So they feel like, ooh, there's technology involved. So they feel included in that kind of big boy, big girl thing if they're little, for example. And in my case, what I did was I introduced YouTube to my children, to the horror of all my friends, because they didn't know what this new YouTube thing was all about. But I saw it as an opportunity for my children to start to build that connection, because they started to develop their own YouTube channel. And of course, they had rules. They couldn't use their own name and all this other stuff. And, you know, I was a digital marketer, so I had knowledge of this. But they wrote scripts. They did costumes. They got friends together. They had to edit. They had to promote it. And they did this as a group. And they had to figure things out and problem solve. So it started to figure back in some of the connection that especially my youngest child had been craving and missing. So he wasn't as good at doing the videos as my older son was, who is now a film editor, but he did some pretty charming things. Oh, and I will say that's how I found out how the sighting got, you know, ruined, or the door got dented, or the mailbox got broken, was because they published all this stuff online. Mom, I don't know how it happened. And then I would pull up a video and I said, well, it looks like you hit it with your bike 14 times. That might have been, you know, how the mailbox got knocked over. You know, I had video evidence. And they recorded it and put it on YouTube.
That is really funny. And yeah, those old stories, that's really good. So going back to this idea of a culture of connection, it's not don't have technology in our lives, but you took the technology, you encouraged the kids to get together in a group activity, and then they utilized the technology as part of that activity, the, you know, creating videos, but they were really doing their own creative thinking to design whatever the video was going to be about. And like you said, do problem solving and all of that. Even the little thing that I mentioned in the opening there about, you know, making TV time about a group in front of a TV, as it becomes a community activity. It's like you invite people over to watch sporting events. This is a group activity. People start making food and bringing things, and you're having conversation, you're talking to people. And it also brought to mind something else that you kind of touched on just very lightly, is you were talking about how you said nobody wants to feel lonely, and you're like almost nobody. And I think nobody wants to be lonely, but some people need more connection than others. You talked about how Charles is a person who really needed a lot of connection. I have a daughter who is very much of a loner and an introvert. She loves and needs a lot of time to herself.
Right.
But she still needs to be connected. It's just giving her ways to do that. So, you know, that group doing a sporting event thing was triggered that thought for me, because she loves to do that. She'll get together when people, we have a family thing at my mother-in-law's, or if we're doing it at our house and we're watching a football game or a hockey game. She's not up in the front jumping up and down and screaming. She's more a little bit removed from the core situation.
Right.
But she'll jump in periodically, and she feels connected to this community of people she cares about. So I think there are lots of things. I don't know if you have other suggestions for creating community, either in our families or our schools.
I think the most important thing is to make the time. What happened when the digital age came in, that which we thought would bring us closer together, has pushed us apart. And one thing we've gotten really guilty of, me included, is overcrowding our own calendars, not leaving enough.
I'm sorry, that's my job. You're right. I have a job because we overcrowd our calendars. That's why I coach people through that, how to fix that.
Exactly, Sandy. And I mean, we're just cramming it with more things. And I mean, when I do have an event, I never know anymore how many people are going to show up. I mean, and try to plan for that. But to make time to go and be with other people. So I work at home a lot. I make sure that every single day I have at least one thing where I am having coffee with somebody. I am going to meet with a group at night, or I am going to go to a network thing first thing in the morning. Because I know that if I go a day without making those connections, I start, that negative voice in my head starts to be more amplified and it gets louder. And I mean, I've learned to combat it, but why spend all that energy combating it when I can go meet with a friend and kind of connect with someone, even if that's just walking a few miles in the morning? That, and also role modeling that, I think is important. So if your kids see that you're just bouncing from one thing to another all the time and not taking time for yourself to connect with your friends, then I think that's just as important. One thing I remember is that all of my friends' children from my book club remember our meetings. Now, our book clubs are not just about the books. It is come in the years past, it's really become kind of more of us telling each other our stories and our family life. And that's the group that I was able to talk to when my son was struggling with addiction and mental illness. So the kids would come in sometimes and they would see us all dancing like crazy. I mean, you know, oh my gosh, this is our song. And we're just going nuts and we are sweating. And you know what? I didn't realize how much those memories are part of their memories. Because now when they're getting married and they're talking about it, they will bring up our book club and about the dancing parties and how we had so much fun, and in that it wasn't all about alcohol. It was about being together, sharing a meal together, you know, the time that we all brought the same side dish, you know, and funny stuff like that. So we had a lot of broccoli that night. And that, you know, broccoli roll and the one piece of chicken was just fine. But, you know, they were able to remember and recall memories that we didn't even remember anymore. So that role modeling of taking that time for yourself is also important. And that might be going to a meditation class, which somebody who's an introvert might prefer that over, you know, some kind of big group activity. So I think it's as much trying to introduce it for your children, but also doing it for yourself.
Yeah, and sometimes you're in a place in your life or in a geographic place where you're like, yeah, that's a great idea, but I don't have friends. I know you talked about that in your book when you had, when your family had to move and you moved away from all your support system and things. I noticed as my younger daughter, you know, as she and her friends got into late high school and college years, that they're all turning to their mothers and going, you need to find some friends. You need a life. Because these are women who, most of them are working part-time or full-time, and they've been raising families and taking care of whatever those core things in their life are. And we haven't made time for friends. And I'm guilty of that too. So even if we don't feel like, oh, I have this group of friends I can call, you're right. You can go to a meditation. You can go to a yoga class, an exercise class, go to a church service. Just get into a public space. And then, you know, depending on your temperament and how much connection you want, be open to having little conversations. It doesn't always have to be a deep and meaningful experience. It can be short exchanges. Say hello to the person in line behind you at the store, whatever. We can start doing that, making those connections. Dads run into the same problems. I hear from them and I talk to them, and they also run into those issues of being isolated. And in some ways it's a little more difficult even for men, because women will have this tendency. I'd read about this where, you know, we'll give each other affirmation, even to strangers.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, cute shirt or whatever. I mean, nothing huge or important. And men don't receive that. They don't, it's not something men do for other men. They don't go, wow, you know, great suit, dude, whatever. And women tend not to do it with men, because especially in a work environment, that can feel a little flirty and you don't want to do that. So I think that doing that is important for us. And then, like you said, even more importantly, we are modeling for our kids that this is important. And it made me think of the family dinner thing too. And I know what a challenge that is. And I have talked before about how our family fell off that bandwagon. And it is one of the things that I regretted, that I wish I'd fought harder for. Not necessarily that it had to be a typical family dinner, but, you know, through those busy high school years and whatnot, when it got pushed down to one day a week, I saw the impact on my family. And this is a secondary impact that I never considered, is that it's just a moment of social connection for every member of our family, or, you know, if need be, the members who can make it to dinner that day. But those little interactions, I think, are hugely important.
I so agree. I also think it's important for people to kind of push through their comfort zone. We kind of do the same things. And this was, I think it was this past weekend when it struck me that I had a book signing, and I had two in my hometown. And it was a big deal because my mother was really excited about them, and her book club was excited because they had picked the book and they were hosting one of them. But there was a newspaper article, and several people who I had never met brought in the newspaper article, and they had highlighted the event, and they came in to talk and to buy a book. And I went up to those women and those men, and I said, thank you for coming, because you took time out of your day and you probably kind of pushed through your comfort zone on this. Because particularly, I mean, you know, it's suicide and addiction, which are kind of stigmatized subjects anyway. And most of them were like, yeah, you know, I did push through my comfort zone here to come attend something. And in some cases, they came by themselves. And I was really impressed with that, you know, people said, you know, I'm going to go do this. And if I have to go by myself, that's fine. And they felt part of the group. And, you know, we had a really nice discussion. And it became something that we hadn't planned. And I just kind of let it go in that direction because I felt like I needed it and the rest of the group did. And I just left that both events just feeling really good with those new connections that you know, we made, and people told me about things that they probably had never told people before. And I think that really creates that special human bond. And we need to look for more of those opportunities and not just do the status quo every single time, because we get kind of stuck in our routine. And where the creativity happens is when you step outside that zone. And that's where that real connection and listening starts to happen.
So there are two things there that I want to touch on a little bit. And one is, we've talked a lot about stepping outside. Well, you said now stepping outside your comfort zone, which is a good one, because where I wanted to go was, we've talked about, you know, reaching out to people, meeting people, talking to people. And one of the ways that we tend to do that, because we don't want to step outside our comfort zone, is we go to social media. And I know that this is something that is in your heart space to talk about. And I just wanted to mention, because the more I read, the more I find out, there are definitely positive aspects to social media. It adds some huge value to my life in very specific ways. But one of the big lies that we believe is that talking to people on social media is connection. And that's really not true. It is not that connection that as human beings we need. And I'd love to hear a little bit more from you on that subject, because I know that you had said that Charles was definitely impacted by social media, that it creates a sense of isolation, actually.
Right. I think that especially with teenagers, we have to realize that they're doing a lot of comparisons. So I know there were hundreds of parties when I was a teenager that I wasn't invited to. Some of them I found out about. But you know what? I didn't go to Instagram or Snapchat or wherever kids like to hang out and see all these pictures of everybody having fun for day after day after day. So it wasn't like my face was pushed into it. And our kids are, you know, that is their world, that they see, oh, you weren't included in this. And instead of just saying that, okay, people can't invite everybody to everywhere, it just, as a teenager, they're not quite used to that. And when we don't set limits on those digital devices, because I'm telling you, you can't monitor their activity online. I don't care how many apps you have. They have a million ways of getting around it. You own the phone as a parent. And I really advocate setting some digital limits from the beginning. You know, no phones in the room at night. But when you take away the device, or not take it away, but if you have limits, they're less likely to become addicted to it, where it is kind of like crack. When you hear a ping, oh, somebody wants me, I need to answer that. And I have to cut it off sometimes and leave it somewhere else, because I need a break from that digital device. But when we give it to them at a young age, they create that habit, and that creates a different, not real meaningful type connection, more of a Pavlov's dog of I need it. And it creates more of an addiction than it does connection. And I think with social media, social media is what they call a two-way app. They've done studies, and one study said that the one-way apps are very healthy. So something like Headspace, where you get in there and you kind of meditate or something like that. But it's the two-way apps that are really difficult for teenagers to sort of figure out their way through, because it just presents a lot of comparison type scenarios that they're not quite ready for yet. And they're always comparing themselves and feeling insignificant. In fact, I went to a high school and I had them all rate, had they felt lonely or insignificant in the last 6 weeks. And 95% of them logged in that they had felt that way. And I think a large part of that is the social media presenting all these scenarios that they're not included in. And I think by limiting that digital device, they can stop going into their heads and comparing themselves of not having all this stuff. Because what we put on social media is our highlight reel.
Mm-hmm. So
we're talking about accomplishments more than we're talking about, you know, when I would talk about my son and some of his struggles, it was, you know, it was ignored. But not only ignored by people, if Facebook has an algorithm and it knows what people want or react to the most, so Facebook is actually ignoring you because you're not getting shown as much. So it starts to feel like people don't care, but how can they care if only two people have seen it compared to, you know, somebody else getting into Yale and hundreds of people have seen it. So there's more than one thing at work here. There is people being attracted by certain successes, but there's also this mechanical thing that we have no control of called the algorithm. And social media is run by this algorithm. And Facebook puts, and other social media put in front of you that which they think is most likely going to get a reaction from you, you know, a comment, activity, because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for activity. They're looking for likes and comments. And that's where the kids get real tangled up there. In that, oh, nobody, I don't have that many likes. Well, I explain to teenagers all the time that that might be the algorithm, not your friends. Because on any given day, if it's really, really busy, Facebook can only show that person so much content. And it makes a mathematical equation of choices of what to put in front of you. And that's based on a history of what you've reacted to in the past. So a lot of people take things personally that have no person involved. But these are complex issues that our kids aren't quite ready to deal with on as much time as they're putting into it. Hey, 15 minutes a day, 30 minutes a day, no big deal. But that can easily become hours. And people get obsessed. They want to kind of find out what somebody's doing. So they'll sort of stalk through the whole Instagram. I mean, and that can turn into being something not very healthy. And I think it's up to us as parents to introduce some kind of healthy balance. And part of that is setting some limits on the digital devices, because we're not going to get through if we're handing over too much to distract them.
And I think we can also look at what types of things they're using. So having those conversations, like you said, there are one-way apps and two-way apps. I know one of the training seminars I went to talked about whether you were consuming or creating. Okay. And how studies showed that, you know, when we have passive consumption of something, like just kicking back and watching a sitcom or something like that on TV or on a device, that, you know, a little bit of it's fine, but that's kind of like eating cake, you know, whereas once you start actually thinking and creating and interacting with people, and the higher you move up to that chain, the more value that digital app or program or device or whatever has, and how it can actually have positive impact. So I'm curious, because that's something you talk about too, is that we can actually use social media to have a positive impact. Could you share a little bit about that with us?
Well, when I started my blog, I wrote a lot, and I would share those blog posts on Facebook because most of my audience is on Facebook. And I wrote this piece about struggling with getting the news of my son's death. And it just gives you kind of a blow by blow of us getting the news and how we reacted. And I remember when I wrote it going, who would ever want to read this? And I really felt ashamed and embarrassed to publish it. But I did publish it, and I didn't share it, but I had subscribers, and I still do a lot more now, but I had a few subscribers then, and they shared it on social media, and all of a sudden, 60,000 people were reading this post that I'd put out there. And I get this message from this girl named Lauren. And it says, 2 days ago, I thought about taking my life. Reading a post from a mother who's felt such devastating pain has changed my perspective on life. And what she had done prior to writing me that note is she had reached out to her parents, told them that she had been struggling with depression, and that she had been struggling with thoughts of suicide for 4 years, and that she was asking for their help. So she was just asking for their help to save her own life. You know, help me save my own life because I don't know what's going on. And what I loved about her post is that she just made the decision right then and there, is like, oh my gosh, I need to do this. And all I did was kind of validate what she already wanted to do. So I started to use digital marketing as a way of helping people find answers. You know, when they Google things, like when the number one, one of the top searches on my site is, how do I help a friend who is cutting? And I must see hundreds of colleges and high school, internet service provider, you can see the name in my statistics, looking that up and looking for the page that kind of gives them a script of what to say and what to do when a friend is cutting. So I'm trying to use it in a more positive way when people are looking for solutions. Because we tell kids a lot of things like, oh, you can ask for help, you can do this, but we don't often kind of give them a roadmap of, okay, here's an example. So I put in some scripts, and they may be even corny scripts, but it gives them an idea of what to say, and they put it in their own words. And what I'm finding from feedback is that people are kind of taking these scripts, and they are creating their own narrative. And they're feeling more confident about how they might approach a situation where they're feeling helpless. And we're not teaching those coping skills in school right now. So kids are looking it up because they're desperate and they want to know how to resolve some of these things they're struggling with. They're not talking to their parents about it, but they are Googling them. So how can I be, you know, kind of a Google parent? And I get a lot of feedback, especially on YouTube. And it's really interesting that it might start off with them looking up something about suicide, something about depression, something about cutting or loneliness or isolation. And they'll start to comment on the video. And I look and I'm like, oh my gosh, we've had an entire conversation because there are 50 comments with me and one young adult or child or whatever it is. And it's really become something I never expected. I mean, it's really interesting because they're really struggling with a lot of basic life kind of function things. Things that I kind of learned earlier because I had more playground time. And they're struggling with a lot, just unexpected things. Like I will talk to teenagers online that, gosh, I may never get married or have a family. I can't see that happening to me because I've never had a date. And they'll be like 20 years old. Well, I didn't date a lot, but I got married and had children. And they're struggling a lot more with that. And I'm just learning more than, I'm learning a lot from their questions. And that's been such a fascinating journey.
Well, and that's a constructive, healthy connection. So we've talked about this today where we've said, okay, we need to cultivate a culture of connection. And that means we need to think about what we're doing. So I'm kind of going back and summarizing some of the ways that we said we can do that. And one is to go, all right, so stop fighting technology because it is part of our lives. But look at how you're going to use that. So if you have technology in your life, look at how it can be part of group activities or how you can take something that is an interest of your child and integrate connection into that activity, even when it's a digital activity. We need to be willing to make time. We have become so busy in this digital age that we don't take the time for the smallest connections. When our kids come home from school, finding out about their day, when they come in from something else, when they seem like there's something struggling, we may need to drop everything and be willing to talk then. We need to put some energy into meeting with people rather than combating the negative feelings that come from isolation. Just put that energy in up front and get out the door, get out of our comfort zone, step out into, you know, join a book club, go to a class, go to a local event, art, music, activities, a lecture, anything, and model that behavior for our kids so they see that these things that build community are an important part of life. And remember that social media is not real connection. It can be a useful tool, but don't consider that a way of connecting with people. If you're feeling lonely, go find face-to-face interaction. And the same thing with our kids. Encourage them to participate in face-to-face activities, and that if they are feeling alone or lonely, to again step into a space where they're with another human being. And remember that when it comes to social media, our teens can feel pressured by what they see, and they can feel lonely and left out by seeing everything that's happening that they aren't part of. That can leave them feeling isolated. And we can help manage that with discussions and limits. We want to have limits on devices because that decreases their reliance and reduces the possibility of addiction to that. And then one last thing, and it's going to be super short, but we're talking about this creating a culture of connection. And one of the other issues that I see across the board of people of all ages is a lot of, even when I am face to face with people, there's a lack of connection because nobody's listening to what's being said. So can you talk a little about that? Because I know that's another passionate piece that you have, Ann Moss. You talk about parents listening truly and empathetically to their kids. And I think it goes beyond that. But could you tell us just a little about that?
I think what I've always said, listen more and lecture less. So if you are so wanting to say what you say that you're repeating it in your head while your child is talking, you're not listening to them. So stop, you know, react to them as they talk, ask them questions so that they know you're engaged in their conversation. And I feel like when has lecture ever worked? Has it ever worked? And I remember telling my son some, him going out the door, and he did exactly that. And he does not remember ever hearing it from me. Because when we lecture and don't ask questions, they don't remember. They have to feel like it's their idea. So I actually switched out my whole parenting style because I wanted them to know I was listening to them. And I still don't think I got that completely right, but I did start to move in that direction, and it was a lot later. But I think that we need to listen more and start to understand the root cause of where they're coming from. Because a drop in grades could mean a fear of something, but it could also mean, you know, their eyesight's not as good and they're struggling to see and everything's fuzzy. But if we're not listening to some of their clues and really trying to pick up on those things, and we're always wanting to give them our wisdom and advice, then we're not going to hear them. And they need to be heard, because that's how you're going to develop a relationship, is once they feel heard, they will start to confide in you. And I found that with my older child. He will tell me anything and ask me anything. And lots of times I'm not feeling, you know, I do feel like, oh, wow, that's too much information. But I don't say that because I'm so glad he's kind of flipped to the other side, where he is just really trusts me, because he knows I trust he'll make the right decision in the end. And I that's what I usually say to him. If I ask him some questions, and those are usually food for thought, so that he will come up with a solution to those questions. So I am planting them there to marinate, so he comes up with his own solution. And by doing that style of parenting, I've noticed he's leapfrogged ages in front of his friends. Because of that, he's developed this skill for problem solving.
And yeah, that one's huge.
And it is. It is huge. And I'm going to slip in one other thing. Wisdom guide is to have one other adult outside your parental unit, that is outside the mother and father, that your kids can connect with when they're struggling with something. Like an aunt, a neighbor, a godfather, someone else that, you know, because they don't want to disappoint you. And there might be an opportunity in the future, if your kid is struggling with something and they don't want to tell mom or dad, but maybe they're willing to tell that significant other or that wisdom guide.
Yes, we've talked about that from different angles on the show before. And I always share that, you know, we did it teasingly, jokingly with our kids. We'd be like, okay, you know, sometimes you're not going to want to come to mom and dad. You get tossed in jail. We hope that you would come to us, but we get you may not want to call us. Who would you call? And by asking, not just saying, oh, you need to find someone, but saying, who would you call? If you were feeling sad and depressed, who would you call? If you feel left out, if you had to make a big decision, didn't know what to do, who could you talk to? Who would that be? And not that they have to tell us, but and you can even say that. You don't have to say it out loud, but I need you to right now in your mind, name that person. Because when they hit a point where they're struggling, especially if it's an emotional or a mental struggle, having already come up with that name is going to be very important. They will already know this is who they have to go to, instead of trying to problem solve in that moment when they're already under stress. So I love that. And I love the asking questions. That's one of our mottos at Mighty Parenting, is to live curious. So that fits right in there. So Ann Moss, for people who want to learn more about what you are sharing, where can they find you?
Well, I'm not hard to find. You can just Google Ann Moss Rogers, but I have AnnMossRogers.com. That's my professional speaking site, because I speak in colleges, high schools, conferences, even jails. And Emotionally Naked is my blog, and I blog every single day, and I talk about being emotionally naked. It's about vulnerability and mental illness and addiction and suicide and grief and all the other topics that we don't want to talk about.
Okay. And so, and Anne is spelled with an E. So I just want to say, so that's annemossrogers.com. And of course, we'll have links to these on our site as well. And then emotionallynaked.com for your blog.
Correct. And the book is Diary of a Broken Mind.
So we have all of that at mightyparenting.com. So thank you, Anne, for sharing everything you shared with us today. And Mighty Parents, thank you so much for joining us today. Remember to pop over to mightyparenting.com to see all that we have to support you, to get detailed show notes, because there's much more than what you see on whatever podcast app you're listening on. And remember, you are a mighty parent and you've got this. So I will see you next week.